You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. My name is Bill Taylor. I'm glad to welcome you here to the Institute of Peace. And in particular, Ambassador Froom, very good to have you here. Wes, good to have you back, as always. This is a great opportunity here today. I'm very pleased that we can welcome delegations from India, policymakers here in the United States. Institute of Peace is focused on conflict and violent conflict around the world, trying to prevent it or resolve it. The Congress set us up in 1984 to do that. We mostly fail, but we try. We try. We're trying in a lot of different places. And there's conflict today. So this is a great opportunity for us to have this conversation. And India is playing an ever larger role. So that's why I'm looking forward to this conversation, led first by Wes Mitchell, on this topic, the role that India can play, in particular with regard to Russia. I have focused in my time here on Russia, in particular the Russia invasion of Ukraine. We were just talking, Ambassador and I were just talking about India's role in that conflict. Neutrality is one, but recognition of the importance of sovereignty and territorial integrity and those kind of principles. Mr. Modi has told Mr. Putin how bad an idea it would be to use nuclear weapons. So India has given some advice to the Russians, and they seem to have followed that advice. So that's a tribute to the influence that India has in the role. There is a peace formula that the Ukrainians have put forward. We were just talking about the one from China, but even more important than one from China is the one from Ukraine. And Ukrainians have a formula that they are having conversations about. Love to have the Indian view of this kind of peace formula. This is the direction that they would like to go. So this is going to be a great conversation here this morning. This is the public version, so this will be on the record. And I'm looking forward to handing this over to Wes Mitchell, who will moderate the conversation. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bill. And my name is Wes Mitchell. I'm a senior advisor at the Center for Russia and Europe. And it's a real pleasure to welcome those of you who are in the room today, but also those of you who are online. I think we have a pretty good online presence. So we've got a lot of spectators, and that's great. And in particular, I want to echo Bill in welcoming our Indian participants who came a very long way. Before I go further, I have to say up top, I have a pollen-induced sinus infection. So I was actually joking to Ambassador Sauron a moment ago. I could come across as sounding like Henry Kissinger, but that's probably not a good calling card to start a conversation with Indians. I don't think Kissinger is held in the same regard in India. So, but if I go into a coughing fit, it's not meant as a sign of disrespect. But we're really pleased to have a fireside chat this morning with one of India's sharpest observers of national security generally. And I think in particular, he's one of the most erudite and articulate observers of India's relationship with Russia, Ambassador Pankaj Sauron. Ambassador Sauron is a veteran policymaker and diplomat. I was hearing a minute ago about how he actually spent some time in Washington as a junior diplomat in the 1990s. He has served in diplomatic roles in Russia, including ambassador to Russia and as High Commissioner to Bangladesh. He was Deputy National Security Advisor to Prime Minister Modi. He is now convener at NatStrat at the Center for Research on Strategic and Security Issues in Delhi and a member of the Indian National Security Advisory Council. Ambassador Sauron, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Wes. Thank you very much for the invitation. A great pleasure to be back in this beautiful city at a wonderful time of the year, pollen notwithstanding. Thank you so much.
We're covering a big waterfront today. You probably saw on the agenda there's big picture geostrategic issues, there's the defense relationship, the energy relationship. So what we want to do with this opening session is give a kind of panoramic view and maybe a preview of some of the themes that are going to come up later in the day, set the discussion. So, Ambassador Sahran, I think it could be useful for our audience here, who may not be deeply familiar with Indian foreign policy, in particular the nature of the relationship with Russia. Start us off, if you will, by just helping us understand where Russia fits on the global map for India, why it's such an important relationship for India, and we can take it from there maybe into some of the separate themes.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Wes. I mean, I'm glad we are actually having this discussion. Let me begin straight away by saying that the India-Russia relationship goes back a long way. It traces its origins to the post-colonial period of Indian foreign policy, and it has actually been one constant in a very, very fast-moving world. It has survived many things. It has survived the improvement in the Indo-US relationship. It has survived the rise of China. It has survived the multiple wars that were fought in the Middle East and Afghanistan. It has actually survived even the collapse of the Soviet Union, except for the decade of the 90s, which, in my opinion, was the only period in which the India-Russia relationship kind of got disoriented and somewhat fell off the radar, both in Moscow and in Delhi. So the one feature about the relationship has been its constancy. And, you know, if we ask ourselves why this is so, I mean, is it born out of ideology? Is it born out of emotion? What are the factors that have gone into this? I think one of the reasons is that, you know, we do not have a common border with Russia. So we do not have border disputes, unlike, say, with China or Pakistan. The Russians have maintained a somewhat hands-off position with regard to India's internal developments. Russia obviously stepped in at a time when our relationship with the West and the United States was bad. Not just the Cold War period, but even subsequently. And if you remember, till almost 2005, we were under US sanctions. And if I just take that particular episode of 2005 to 2008, the 3 years in which we negotiated the nuclear deal with the United States, it's extraordinary that the Russians were actually quite okay with it. And the Americans were also quite okay with our relationship with Russia at that time. But the fact is that, you know, extraordinarily speaking, the India's nuclear program, the energy the civil nuclear program, actually had Russian cooperation much more than American cooperation. Yet, the Americans at that time agreed to actually do the heavy lifting for India in the lifting of the sanctions and mainstreaming India when it came to nuclear technology and lifting the sanctions, knowing full well the India-Russia relationship. So both the Americans and the Russians actually lived with this reality. So Russian political help on Kashmir, I would say Russian willingness to give technology, military technology, at a time when India did not have any other supplier. Russian support in the Security Council, non-interference, generally speaking, in India's internal affairs, lack of any bilateral contentious border or territorial disputes. These were, I think, some of the factors.
Let's look back at the eve of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I think I read India had something like 20,000 civilians in Ukraine at that moment. Were you surprised by the scale or intensity? A lot of people in the United States were.
No, we were surprised. We were surprised by the decision to go in. Having said that, I must also say that, at least as far as the Indian establishment is concerned, they were well aware of what was brewing in Ukraine since 2014. And I myself, as the ambassador in Moscow, was in close touch with the European ambassadors and with the American embassy. And we knew that all was not well in Ukraine. We were monitoring the Minsk Accords and the Normandy format discussions. We were outsiders, but to the extent one could, we knew. So we were aware that things are not going as per plan. We were also aware that the issues involved were so intractable that it would be very difficult to find a solution, because if Donetsk and Luhansk were part of the Minsk Accords, you know, you had automatically conceded that they had a locus standi in any peace agreement. So we were aware that something was going on. We couldn't understand the timing of the action on February 24th, but we also knew that with the Democratic administration in Washington, that didn't bode well for the overall relationship, although the presidents had met in Geneva in 2021. So we were hopeful that things might actually look forward rather than backward. So in terms of the timing, we were surprised. In terms of the scale, obviously, like everyone else, we had read the leaks in the media about the impending invasion. So, but even till the end, we were hoping that this would not happen. But of course, it did. And then, you know, we of course all saw President Putin's speeches to his people on the 22nd and 23rd, and even before the invasion, he spoke about the two republics and so on. So, and I must say that from the Indian point of view, this could not have come at a worse time, because if you remember, in February 2022, we were just about coming out of the mess and the abyss of the COVID pandemic in India. And also, we were in almost the thick of our conflict with China on the border. So from an Indian perspective, this was the last thing that we wanted. We were actually looking to emerge from these two crises. And the Modi government was really concentrating on domestic transformation and economic rebuilding of the country. So this was a big hit, I would say.
We're now obviously in a multi-year war in Ukraine, and I think in the United States and in many Western countries, there's been not just a strategic and political, but an emotional reaction to the war. And that has grown as we've seen the barbarism, the atrocities that have been committed by Russian troops. From India's perspective, I think I read, just to show you the difference in perspective, that in the early days of the war, something that was trending in Indian social media was hashtag We Stand With Russia. How, if at all, has the Indian mood or view of the situation in Ukraine changed over time? Is it do you see a change either politically or emotionally, or does it just start to fade into the headlines, or what's the...
Yeah, so, you know, India is a large country with multiple opinions, multiple interest groups. So it's possible that, and there is no doubt, a popular sentiment basically in favor of Russia. I mean, Russia is not looked upon as an enemy country in large parts of India, unlike, for example, if you were to conduct an opinion poll about how Indians look at China. So there is a clear difference between the Indian perception of Russia and the Indian perception of China. And I think this is something which we as Indians and Americans need to actually talk much more. When it comes to the evolution, I think the primary change today has been to assess the situation on the battlefield. In the sense that people are interested to know what's actually going on, who's winning, who's losing, and number two, where is it all going to end? So we went through this phase in 22 and 23, which was dominated by India's energy imports and oil imports from Russia, etc. And, you know, Prime Minister Modi and the Indian establishment actually went forward with this completely new initiative of kind of expressing the emotions of the Global South. And they had this summit of the voice of the Global South and so on. So I think we went through those phases too. But then We also continued to maintain contacts with Moscow and with European countries, European leaders, and of course the United States. So I think the intention in India was to somehow douse the flames, not contribute to making things worse, to leverage your relationships and equities with the Russian leaders to tell them that, look, whatever is happening is having a serious impact on the rest of the world, to sensitize them. And I think to Europe and to the United States, but more to Europe, I think we were saying, look, our relationship with Russia is not going to come in the way of our relationship with Europe. And in fact, if you look at the history of these 2 years, there is a definite discernible increase in the scale and the quality of our relationship with Europe, and including the Baltics, the Eastern European countries, not to speak of old Europe, and of course with the United States. So what India tried to do was to fire on all cylinders rather than get into this situation of choosing either or. And that was insofar as the parties are concerned, and insofar as the global, let's say, the southern street is concerned. India was also very much in touch with that section of the international community. And the idea was, so today, it's not expressed so openly, but there is a feeling that perhaps India can in some way contribute to the lessening of tensions and contribute to finding an exit or a pathway to peace. We are not overambitious, we are not idealistic about this. The difficulties are immense, because I think what is at stake today is a fundamental issue about what kind of a security architecture that will emerge from what is going on. And of course, I would say, and that's my last point, the people were extremely concerned about the impact of this and the focus of everyone on the rise of China. Because China is something that dominates the Indian strategic mind space. And for India, that in a sense is really the primary strategic challenge. I don't mean that we look at China necessarily as an adversary, but we need to develop policies and strategies mm-hmm. on how to deal with China.
Well, since you've mentioned China, I was struck by some of the language that came out of the Chinese Foreign Ministry last month on the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh. And as a longtime observer of Russia, what stood out to me was how similar the feel of that language is to when the Russians talk about Ukraine, the deep historical and cultural and connection. And I wonder, I'm looking at the Indian position on Ukraine. I know that India has abstained from several very important UN votes against Russia. The US position, you're very much aware of, is that the invasion is a violation of the United Nations Charter principles of territorial integrity and sovereignty. Do you worry that the Indian stance on Ukraine undercuts its position on its own territories vis-a-vis China? Do you see any contradiction there?
No. So on the principles of territorial integrity, sovereignty, I think India has repeated this many, many times in different forums in the United Nations, in the Indian Parliament, in official statements. We've said this repeatedly at every stage. So I think on that, our position has been pretty forthright. Insofar as the China-India and the use of the Chinese language is concerned, look, you know, the fact is, if you look at the history of India, and I was looking at it before coming here, from 1947, effectively, India has been engaged in about 6 wars collected between Pakistan and China. And today, China occupies approximately, if I'm not wrong, 56 to 58,000 square kilometers of Indian territory in Aksai Chin, in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir and the territories ceded by Pakistan to China under the 1963 so-called treaty. So we have our territory under Chinese occupation. The question, therefore, is what do we do? And that's my first point. So it's not as if what they said last year on Arunachal is something new. You know, it's something which obviously we have rejected as actually having no basis. But on the issue of the comparison between Russia and Ukraine and China and India, I have a different view. You know, India is no Ukraine and China is no Russia. So I think if you have to make a comparison, you have to make it slightly more differently. Because in the case of China and India, there is no third party. But in the case of Russia and Ukraine, there is a third party. You have the NATO, you have the European Union, you have the United States, which are in some way or the other a part and parcel of the conflict. So I would say, in my opinion, and it's personal, if you're looking at how smaller states are used and which are neighbors of larger states, how they are being used to somehow create problems for the bigger state, then my comparison would be slightly different between the Russia-Ukraine conflict and what India faces in its neighborhood.
You mentioned the possibility of an Indian role at some point in ending the conflict. Prime Minister Modi is probably one of the few people in the world, national leaders, who could pick up the phone, call Putin and Zelensky, and they'd both pick up the phone. Do you see a role for India as a mediator or as somehow helping to bring about an end to the fighting at the right time?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've had a history in the 1950s in the Korean War. I think India actually in many ways, if you look at our own internal problems within the country, I think New Delhi has probably had the maximum experience in peacemaking, peace building, conflict resolution within our own country between different states of India on the most difficult domestic issues which look impossible to solve. So at that level, I think New Delhi is a natural kind of a peacemaker, and it has this track record. But yet, I don't think India is going to rush into this because I think they have enough political sense and understanding of the complexities, the kind of players involved. You're talking about, you know, the richest countries of the world, the most powerful militaries of the world. You're talking about the European continent. So, I mean, there is a lot of awareness about the limits to Indian effectiveness. But we think that the relationship we have with all sides, Europe, the United States, and Russia, is an opportunity, and which is why I was actually personally I found that particular conversation very significant a few weeks ago when Prime Minister Modi spoke the same day to both the presidents, and we had the visit of the Ukrainian foreign minister to India. Recently, our national security advisor visited St. Petersburg for a conference in Russia. I think all this is good, it's helpful. I think India would be ready, but at the right time, in the right circumstances. We've been invited for the Swiss conference in June, being arranged by the Swiss and the Ukrainians. But so there is, you know, awareness that we can, there's willingness, but it's not as if you're going to rush into it, I would say. And also, I think it's obviously clear that the solutions are very complex. On how you can firstly de-escalate and secondly find a solution. And I think we are in new territory out here. That's my feeling.
When Foreign Minister Kuleba was in Delhi, he talked about Ukraine's 10-point peace plan, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And some of the provisions in that plan include the release of prisoners, restoring Ukraine's territorial integrity, withdrawing Russian soldiers, guarantees for security. Are there any provisions from that plan that stand out to you from an Indian perspective that India could really get behind and champion, or is it what's the Indian view of the Ukrainian plan?
So I think India today is going to support any prospect of peace and any solution that is put forward. What I know, I'm not in the government anymore, is that in the previous summits in Copenhagen and Saudi Arabia and others, India, along with Brazil, South Africa, Saudi Arabia, etc., I think the point that the Indians made was that if any peace process has to succeed, it has to have some Russian buy-in. Because, you know, the question is, you can actually stitch it up, but then how durable is that going to be, and whether it will unravel again? And if I may, I think there is this worry about what happens if Ukraine is defeated or if it loses the war. My response to that would be, what happens if Russia is defeated or loses the war? I think here we have a situation where defeat of both sides is going to lead to further instability. And this is a strange kind of conflict where we do not, where humiliation and kind of defeat is not going to add to a medium long-term stability in the world, obviously not in Europe. So the exact components of the Ukrainian peace plan is something I'm sure our people are looking at. But on the whole, if you really want some durability and some something to stick, you also have to look at security guarantees or assurances. And I think there was this recent Foreign Affairs article, which is quite interesting, about the whole dynamics in 2022. So there are many, you know, balls being tossed up in the air. And all of them can be picked up and, you know, located in some kind of a solution. So we'll see. I mean, I think it's pretty much work in progress as far as we can make out.
You mentioned the knock-on effects of the war, and I think you're right. It's in the course of the last 2.5-3 years, a lot has changed in geopolitics as a result of the conflict worldwide. And one of them, obviously, is Russia's getting a lot closer to China. And you see it in the economy sphere, you see it in energy. It's looking at the data, it's almost as if Russia will become a ward of the Chinese economy in some ways. How does that affect India's strategic calculus going forward? If you're looking ahead and you think of Russia playing that role in the future, the way it did in, say, the Cold War, where it would help to take a little bit of the Chinese pressure off of India at the right moment, do you think it'll be in a position to do that in the years ahead, or do you think it'll be so much of a bolt on to China after the war that it's not so much of an independent player?
Yeah, so I think, clearly one of the subjects which is being studied intensely in India is the nature and the shape and the future of the Russia-China relationship. The way I think a lot of people in India see it is that to some extent the Russian pivot or the shift to China is involuntary. They have been forced to seek solace and strategic comfort from China. The question is whether we can arrest that trend. That's the first thing. Second thing is, insofar as the interplay between Russia, China, and India is concerned, I think we see there is a Russian desire expressed to us that they do not want to put all their eggs in the Chinese basket. And they want to keep India in play in the Asia or the Indo-Pacific region. So there is that interest in Russia. We also know for a fact that there are all kinds of complications between Russia and China, which are real, which are somewhat being papered over right now because of short-term exigencies. But in the medium to long term, these exist. And lastly, you know, a lot of the relationship and this interaction is also dictated by geography. If you look at the map and see where India is located, it is a fact that Eurasia is critical for India. Today, India has a problem with China. We have a problem with the China-Pakistan relationship. People in India will be very careful not to do anything which might generate a third party to this axis, the China-Pakistan axis, which would be a strategic, let's say, a blunder for India. So the Indian effort will continue to be to work towards keeping Russia and China and providing Russia some options in their foreign policy. So, so far what we have seen is that Russia has tried to deal with India in a manner that is quite different from the manner in which China has dealt with India. And by this I mean things like access to our leadership, maintaining high-level connections and contacts with India. You know, they're obviously doing all this deliberately to show to the Chinese also. Then also I think the Russians are watching how China, despite this friendship between Russia and China, is actually fairly successful and not really holding back in its dealings with Europe, France, Germany, and others, and with the United States. So you have a situation where Moscow is watching how Beijing is going out of its way to cultivate Europe and the United States. And these are exactly the people with whom today Russia is at war. So it doesn't speak well of a Russia-China relationship where you see your best friend being in bed, so to say, with your primary adversaries. So there are complexities, there are... but when you ask me the question what attitude or position Russia would take in the event of an India-China, I would say the answer to that depends. It cannot be a simple answer. It depends on what you mean by an India-China problem. I mean, there are shades and shades and degrees of problems we could have with China. Starting with minor skirmishes, starting with economic and hybrid warfare, right up to a full-fledged military conflict. So I would reserve, you know, any blanket kind of an answer to that. It's, I think it's all going to be situational. We have some anecdotal evidence about the Russian positions, let's say during Doklam in 2017 and in 2020 during the Galwan period. I would agree that from a Russian perspective, a breakdown in the India-China relationship is going to be very difficult for them.
I think a lot of people here in the United States have, and elsewhere, have been surprised by the poor performance of Russian military equipment in Ukraine. And of course, the war, and the longer it goes on, I think this will even be more the case, place a substantial drain on what the Russians can do with their weapons in international markets. I noticed that the Russians are not one of the contenders in the competition for the next generation Indian fighter. How do you see the defense relationship changing as a result of the war? Is it correct to observe that it seems to be getting thinner, or do you think it's still in the cards as the major supplier?
You know, actually, it's good you're talking about the India-Russia defense relationship, because it has a history, it has a present, it has a future. It's no secret that about 60 to 70% of our equipment is of Russian origin. It's also known that we still depend on a lot of technological assistance from Russia to service and to maintain and to upgrade this equipment. But I would say that, so a lot of our people have been watching the Ukraine conflict closely to see Russian military performance. And I can just tell you what the Russians have told, I mean, me and others in private, is that so far the kind of weaponry that they have used in Ukraine is not their full military power, which they obviously have developed over decades to fight not Ukraine, but to fight a war with NATO. So they are pretty confident of what they have in reserve and what they haven't used yet. But Having said that, I would say that if you look at the trend line, the basic shift, I think, took place after the nuclear deal between India and the United States in 2008. And maybe that could be the point in history where the shift began. The sanctions were lifted, sanctions against sending high technology to India, military commerce opened. We started the first few major acquisitions in 2010, and the figures speak for themselves. If you look at the, or if you compare the volumes in terms of dollar volumes between 2010 to now, and you look at the expenditures which India has incurred in purchasing from the United States vis-a-vis Russia, I think the figures speak for themselves. And it's not like a marginal change. It's a pretty significant change. So the Indian defense budget is fixed. The question is, in this case, it's sometimes boils down to an either-or kind of a situation there. And so I think the... So that's one thing. I mean, the diversification of India's military imports. This has happened in parallel with a clear decision by the Modi government on development of an indigenous industry. And the question here is going to be, in the medium to long term, whether the United States or whichever partner, whether it's France or Israel or the United States or Russia, which of them is actually going to be most forthcoming in helping India to develop an indigenous, an credible indigenous military or a defense industry. People doubt the initial successes of this program, which is valid. I mean, it's not easy. There have been some really difficult reforms that have taken place in India to move in this direction of greater indigenization. But I think it's important that a relatively new defense partner like the United States should be aware that this is not the India of the 20 years ago, where it was simply a question of, you selling and India buying, which was actually the, in some ways, also the Russian model. We are entering new territory, and I think it's important that the defense relationship has a robust combination of selling, but also contributing to technology. And I think the last few years, some really difficult decisions have been taken in this field by the US. And so this is laying the foundations for, because if you buy a platform today, whether it's in the Navy or the Air Force, you're talking of a dependency of maybe 3 or 4 decades. And that's the longevity of the dependency. So it's not easy to snap links immediately. And the fact is that today, if India has the kind of capabilities that it has, these have been built over decades. And I would like to believe that capabilities today are more credible than they were vis-a-vis the Chinese, than they were in the 60s and 70s. And so obviously there has been this progressive build-up. This is where we are today. It's also recognized in India that today, because of the geopolitical developments, India needs the best technologies available in the world, and it will try to source them. And obviously, we also are aware that this doesn't come for free. So, in any relationship, the most sensitive is the military relationship, and that actually happens only when there is trust and confidence. And I think we are in that phase, I think, in our relationship where we are doing all this.
I want to make sure I have time for a couple of questions from the audience, but let me ask you one more thing that I'm sure will come up in the course of the discussions today, and that's the political character of the competition that's underway between the West and Russia and China. You've written that you disagree with characterizing this as a battle between democracy and authoritarianism. Help us understand why that doesn't resonate in India.
You know, look, our relationship with Russia is no secret. It's been there for 70 years. It's been known to the whole world. And it has existed despite the political formations in Russia. And it is not as if the India-Russia relationship has suddenly come out of the closet. It's another thing maybe that it's come into focus now because of Ukraine. But whether it was the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, whether it was Gorbachev or Yeltsin or Putin, this relationship has existed. And if you look at India's relationships with countries, you will find that it's less ideological than maybe the kind of relationships that the United States has with other countries. I mean, we've tried to build relationships with China, we've tried to build relationships with other major powers. So I think this idea that India's relationships, I mean, let's say, for example, how we deal with Myanmar, or how we even, for example, dealt with Pakistan or Bangladesh. I mean, all these countries have had decades of military dictatorships. So sometimes you have no choice but to deal. Sometimes you are not in a position to shape internal outcomes in other countries. And that is a function of your own national power. And that is also a function of trying to make the best of what you have. So sometimes you may not have the luxury to base relationships on what you think is good for the other partner. So I would say that you know, there are different kind of impulses which go into which into these kind of partnerships.
Well, I want to collect a couple questions from the audience. I'm only able to draw on questions in the room, not from online. But if there are questions, I would just ask that you identify yourself and your organization and stand up, and one of our microphone helpers can get to you. So any questions in the room? In the back?
Hi, Ambassador Sarant, Samir Lalwani from the U.S. Institute of Peace. Thank you for your remarks this morning. I wanted to go back to the question of Russia and China and ask, maybe at a point in the future when U.S. and Indian intelligence communities assess that this has passed a point of no return, that the Russia-China relationship is, for all intents and purposes, an alliance, what does India do then? How do you sort of calibrate after that point? And I recognize that that may not be the point now, but potentially in the future.
Yeah. Look, you know, if it actually develops into a kind of an alliance, it will fundamentally alter India's strategic scenario in the neighborhood. I mean, that is quite obvious. From an Indian perspective, that is in fact the worst case scenario, where you go from a two-front or a two-front threat to a three-front threat. My response to your question would be, what can we do as India to prevent that from happening, and whether we can prevent that from happening? And here I would say it's important for India and the United States, and it's important for India to be able to talk to the United States and to Europe to kind of sensitize them to the grave threat this would pose to India, and also to talk to the United States about its own strategic concerns and compulsions. In 1991, the Soviet Union was defeated without a single shot being fired. The Soviet Union collapsed, communism was defeated. What I find a little problematic is that with every international global crisis, it's the Chinese who are actually taking away the net benefits, whether it was 2008, whether it is 2022. So I think India and the United States have a common interest actually out here to find strategies to deal with the power of the future, not in the sense the power that was. And I would say that, you know, while it is tempting to look at this development and look at this scenario, we should be actually exerting all our energies to ensure that this kind of a scenario does not happen. And if my conversations with the Russians and others within Russia actually indicate that they're very conscious. I mean, if you use the term junior partner or younger brother or and so on, frankly, if you look at the map and you realize Russia is the largest country in the planet in terms of area, and you look at the history of Russia, it's not an inevitability, I would say. But we will come to that bridge when we do. I mean, that's all one can say. But to take it as a given or that it is inevitable, I think would be, in a sense, throwing in the towel and saying, look, you know, this is what is happening. And this is where I think the US and India and Europe, we can all actually play a part and work together. I think you have to look in the future and look at, you know, rising powers, I mean, and what threats and challenges that rising power face, has to the rest of the world. I mean, for me, that is really sitting in Delhi, the big challenge.
No additional questions in the audience? Ashley.
Good to see you, Ambassador Sarin. Good to see you again. Can I follow up on the question that Samir just asked? Because it seems to me that U.S. interests and Indian interests converge on the fact that we do not want Russia to become a satellite of China. But I'm not sure that the priorities between the U.S. and India are necessarily at the same level, in the sense that for the U.S., the most important challenge right now is to strengthen Ukraine, which means continuing the confrontation with Russia until there is some change from the current status quo. Whereas for India, the challenge is to strengthen Russia in ways that allow it to peel away from China. Now, if my assessment of this incongruity is correct, how do we square the circle?
Yeah, so this is, I think, the big question we have to discuss between ourselves. So as I said initially, look at the consequences of a Russia that's defeated in Ukraine or is vanquished. I mean, do you think in your estimation that is going to serve your purposes in the longer term? I mean, I realize what happens if Ukraine is defeated or is humiliated. I can understand that. But I would also like you to think of that scenario where you have a humiliated, defeated, isolated, secluded Russia. And do you think that's going to be good for the United States? Is it going to be good for the future of the Russia-China relationship? You know, it's one thing to have smaller countries being driven into Chinese arms, but it's another to have, and you know, this will happen under sufferance because the Russians are, I mean, if you know a little bit about them, they're proud. They're extremely self-conscious about their glorious history and who they are. I'm not saying that. So, the question is whether a weak Russia or a weaker Russia, I mean, and from an Indian and an American point of view, how do we position ourselves on that issue? Do we want a strong Russia? Do we want a weak Russia? I mean, that's a subject that is a good point for discussion. I mean, you know, if you have 6,000 nuclear warheads, you know, you are under stress. In my opinion, you know, if you're talking, I mean, what are the future scenarios you're looking at for Russia? I mean, a breakup, I mean, once again, after 30 years, a change in regime in Moscow. I mean, what is it that is going to resolve or solve the problems? Russia is not going anywhere. It is here to stay. The question is whether we can agree among ourselves on how to, and yeah, I agree with you. I know what the Baltics feel about Russia. That's perfectly understood in Delhi. And you know, it's how we feel in the Indo-Pacific. So there is a bit of a strategic dissonance. I would grant that. But I would say, if we have our eye on the bigger picture and the future fundamental challenges to how we are going to arrange the international system and the global order, then we might follow different pathways to actually address the same challenge. I mean, you can argue, for example, what if you had the opposite true, which is a weak China and a strong Russia. I mean, you know, you know, there are different solutions to that scenario. When Putin took over as president in 1999 and 2000, I would say till about 2008 or so, you know, he was well regarded or accepted in the G7, in the Western world, in Europe, in the United States. We had, as I said, the most fundamental moment of Indo-US transformation precisely between 2005 to 2008 under the same president in Moscow. So we've had, there are cases, I mean, there is historical evidence that we've actually managed to deal with the same Russia, the same person, the same Kremlin, as we did 15 years ago. We have an issue about European security. I mean, the fact is that the breakup of the Soviet Union, these after effects are being faced today, after 30 years. I mean, imagine 1991, not a single shot was fired. But today, maybe you are seeing the after effects and the aftermaths of that cataclysmic change. And how do you square this circle today? So the question is, how much of our mental space and our mind space is going into this issue? And there is someone else sitting out there was actually watching you and me and saying, this is good. Because in whichever way it goes, it suits my purpose. So if he's seeing that you are preoccupied, I'm not just saying in terms of money, but in terms of everything else, in terms of equities, political capital, the cost you're paying in the global south, everything else. You know, are we repeating history? Are we kind of making the same mistakes again in front of our eyes? Who was the single biggest beneficiary of the 2008 global crisis? If you map the rise of China, historically speaking, the cutoff point actually is 2008. So maybe we should ask ourselves, what will 2022, when history is written after 10, 15 years, show in terms of what it meant for the relative balance of power between, let's say, China and the United States and the West. You know, I would like to... So I would say the discussion on Russia is interesting, it's important. But the question is whether it is fundamental to the threats and the challenges that we face. That's really my submission.
I think I saw a question over here on the right, the lady on the right.
Tanvi Madan from Brookings. Thank you, Ambassador. Saran, I had a question that was separate, but I just wanted to follow up on Samir and Ashley's questions and your answers. As you said, Russia is a proud, independent country. It's made its own choices as well. And where it is today is not just in terms of what the U.S. has done, Europe has done, or India has done or not done for Russia, but Moscow's choices as well. And so what does Russia need to do at this point? We've talked about what others need to do, but what does Russia need to do to keep its own independence from China and prevent it from becoming that junior partner that it doesn't want to become in the situation it finds itself today? The other question I had was about the Russia-India-China dynamics. Have you seen a change in how Russia and China are dealing with each other or interacting with each other, but also vis-a-vis India in groupings like BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or has it remained fairly steady over time? Thank you.
Thank you, Tanvi. I mean, I think on the first, Russia, I think deep down realizes that the trajectories they took between the Russians and the Chinese have been so different. And the record speaks for itself about who has been the most successful model, because they both began with communist parties. So in one case, you had 1991, you had a Gorbachev. In this case, they took a very different path. So I think deep down, they do realize that they have actually not succeeded in fulfilling the theoretical potential of that country. I mean, that country has everything that you would imagine and want for. I mean, they have everything that you can think of. Yet, their economic and technological successes have been outshone by the Chinese. So, Russia really needs to do some kind of deep introspection about what is the solution to domestic rejuvenation, to meeting the potential that they have. Obviously, and they've admitted it themselves, and I think their number one strategic challenge and threat is demographic. 140 million people with a stagnant population after decades of efforts to increase is a huge risk and a threat to Russian internal security and the prospects of economic growth. I mean, when we had the Soviet Union, and I was there, I think Mikhail Gorbachev understood this. And, you know, he came in from the blue. For me, that was also a fantastic strategic surprise, the rise of Mikhail Gorbachev. Because if you remember at that time in 1983-84, we had a succession of deaths of general secretaries. They were all gerontocracies, they were 80-year-olds. And then this 52-year-old from nowhere came, and then from 85 till 1990. But after that, so the promise was there that once you kind of do away with the republics and you have the pure Russian Slavic heartland, then maybe that could be the takeoff point for economic growth, technological growth. That has not happened. So number one, I would say they have to do much better economically, internally. They have to reform structurally. Now the question is whether that economic reform can come without political reform, or if you tinker too much with the economy, will that entail political reform, which maybe they don't want, the current Kremlin does not want. So that's one issue. Second is, again, you know, when it comes to the relationship between Russia or China with the West, it's interesting that the two have taken such different paths. Now the question is whether the Russians are watching how the Chinese have managed the West and how the Russians have managed the West or not managed the West. So you would have imagined, logically speaking, that the integration between the Russian and the European economies would have far exceeded that between the Chinese and the European economies. But apart from energy, the rest of the integration has been very minimal. So now, how much of it is actually cultural and civilizational? The question we have to ask ourselves is, are we doomed to live in a situation where Russia and the West, there's no meeting ground, or they cannot coexist? Is that something? I mean, that really is, because we all thought in 91 that, you know, finally the curse of the Cold War was over. But I think today, after 30 plus years, we're almost back to square one. And so people are asking, is there something inherent in this division? Is it something that can never be reconciled, or is there no solution to it? I mean, how come China's interactions with the West have been far more productive and helpful to China than Russia's? So whether Russia can look at all this and reinvent its approach to the West, to Europe, to the United States, is one part of the story. And the other part of the story is whether Europe and the United States can have a relook at Russia. I mean, tomorrow, theoretically speaking, or let's say even yesterday, you had Boris Yeltsin, 10 years, market friendly, the golden period of the Russia-US relationship. But the question is, was that an aberration? It was the Putin era, the kind of default position? Or was the Yeltsin period the default position, and the Putin era is an aberration? And what shape and form would a post-Putin Russia take? I mean, what kind of a governance structure do you think Russia would have in the future? And in whose image should Russia develop? And now on the second part, so all these actually get internalized when you look at Russia and China and BRICS and Shanghai and their approach to India. It's quite interesting that the more vociferous between the two and antagonistic against the West is the Russians and not the Chinese. And they sit in the same room. And obviously everyone is listening to every word that is being said and the tone and the tenor of the statements that is coming across. And clearly you have a situation where the Chinese are allowing the Russians to vent and to say the worst possible things, but they're not copying them. They are staying back. And so this distinction between how the Russians are using these organizations vis-a-vis how the Chinese are using is interesting to watch. And it's also interesting, more interesting, because everyone in the room knows the relative power of Russia and China. And on the India and how they behave with India, here I would say, again, it follows from, it kind of builds up on the previous conversation. The Russian attitude to India and the Chinese attitude to India. Let's say when it came to India's membership of the Shanghai Organization or the BRICS, we see a clear difference. There is a very clear difference. I mean, had it not been for Russian support, India would not have probably got membership of the Shanghai. So it was clearly, you know, unsaid. We don't like to talk about it, but, you know, the Chinese were batting for the Pakistanis, you know, the Russians were kind of, you know. So there was this also, paradoxically, a bit of a kind of power play going on. So so that's how the dynamic is. I mean, you can make out, you can see hostility where it is coming, and you can see at least non-hostility where it is coming. So.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I wish we had more time, but we don't. Ambassador Sahran, I'm impressed by how you've helped us look at the map from India's perspective, and I'm struck by the sophistication of your strategic analysis, and it just underscores to me what I think will be talked about in greater detail in some of the other panels, that it is a very complex geopolitical moment we're living through. And it underscores to me the indispensability of the U.S.-India relationship and conversations like the one that we're having here. So please join me in thanking Ambassador Sahran for this very interesting conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.